This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 18th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we're asking, how do you write a biography? It's no small question, is it? How do you choose your subject? Hero, villain, former Man United manager, pop legend? Are the rules the same for them all? We'll marvel at the strangeness of profiling the former dear leader of North Korea in print. We'll get up to our neck in the legals with an amusing biographical trip to Brazil. And we'll hear how to sell those ripping yarns too. Plus, we'll hear from a ghostwriter about how to disappear completely from the storytelling process.
I eventually said, look, this is hopeless. I'm going to have to move in with you because otherwise we're just not going to get the material. And that obviously means that you do get very close to them.
That's all to come right here on this Churchillian edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. First up, we're going to investigate the world of the ghostwriter. The what? The ghostwriter. The scribes who write the autobiographies of footballers, soap stars, reality TV winners, with a sleight of hand that's all about getting that tone of voice just right, while acknowledging that the name on the book at the end will be that of the star themselves. So how do you ghostwrite an autobiography, and what is the relationship between the writer and the writer like? Fanny Blake, who's penned many a memoir for famous names, talked us through the tricks of the trade.
It's quite a complicated relationship, which begins at a kind of beauty parade.
Right.
Or at least, I'm talking obviously about my own experience. Yeah. Others may have found it different. So what has happened is that somebody is paid squillions for their life story, and then they need somebody to write it. Because why should a footballer be able to write his own autobiography? His skills are elsewhere. So you get called along to an interview and you have a chat with them and their lawyer, agent, whoever they bring along. And then you go away and wait for the call or not.
And is that conversation done in very broad brushstrokes? Do you have to get on with the footballer, for example? Or is it good to keep a very professional relationship so that you can weed out the boring bits rather than being always having to sort of, invest in what they think of the
best? Well, I think you probably have to have a bit of both. I mean, you have to remain detached enough because you have to be able to say to them, all the newspapers have reported you in the past as being a drug-addled lesbian.
Yeah.
And you don't want to address that. Which is fair enough, it's your book, but we are going to somehow have to write round it. So you have to be able to have that conversation. But at the same time, you have to develop a relationship with them so that they want to talk to you and so that they want to tell you the stories. Because if you can't sit down and hear the anecdotes and they don't feel relaxed enough to tell you them, you're not going to have any material for a book.
And then it goes on, and then you get the call, you get the contract, and then you start sitting down. Where do you sit down? Do you go out for lunch with these people, or is it very much, you hire a hotel room and you thrash out the details, you have a certain amount of allotted time? How does the storytelling process go?
Well, I've always been quite lucky in as much that they've been very generous with, all the people that I've worked with have been very generous with their time. And so I have, without exception, I think, gone to their homes. Mm. One of them who was, which I'll come to, rather reluctant to get going, I eventually said, look, this is hopeless. I'm going to have to move in with you because otherwise we're just not going to get the material. So I have lived with them. And I have travelled. Somebody I worked with was training in South Africa. So I went to South Africa and lived in their house there for a little while. And that obviously means that you do get very close to them.
Do you feel for many of your subjects, there's been an act of catharsis for them to spill the beans? Or has it been for them much a mercantile consideration?
Probably not catharsis. I think mercantile is probably first and foremost.
Okay.
And they say, well, I'll tell you this, and this really happened with my mum, but you can't, you mustn't tell anyone. And the reason that I'm telling you this is because it puts the rest of my behaviour in some sort of perspective, but you'll have to find a way of writing round that without mentioning the unmentionable.
The unmentionable. How often has that happened? How frustrating is that when someone is giving you a rattling yarn and then, of course, at the end, the anecdote with, well, of course, unfortunately, we can't put that in the book, of course. How much of you have to have been convinced to say, do you know what? People know who you are. People respect you for this. It's fine. You have to, and that's the therapist side of things.
No, you do. You have to try to, get as much as you can on the page. But if they don't want to, I think then you have to respect that.
Yeah.
And let's face it, anybody writing their own autobiography fashions it
to suit their own needs.
Exactly. I mean, that's what they do.
Do you get, I mean, from footballers to soap stars to whoever, has anyone struck you as being fantastically good at knowing what people want of them, what people want to read about when they read a book by them? Or do you really have to sort of steer the editorial process, the storytelling process? Has anyone been very easy, I guess?
Well, it depends completely. I mean, I did work with an athlete, an Olympic athlete, who was extraordinary. I mean, she remembered every single race she'd ever run, I think, and who was running in it, where they came, what was happening down the back straight, etc.
This is the mark of a competitive brain, I think.
Yes.
This is a competitor's brain. Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. That is true. And it was absolutely fascinating. And of course, yeah, I did watch all the videos, and she was absolutely, she remembered it bang on all the time. But of course, that is what people reading her autobiography would want. She knew which ones to pick, which ones had a good story. They were very aware of the kind of thing and very good at telling anecdotes. Whereas I have worked with people who are very good at a kind of one-liner, but who are less able to tell a good story, which, of course, when you're getting a good story, you think, God, this is great. This is a couple of pages worth.
And you listen to your tape back again, and really it's two lines.
Yes.
You know? And Fanny, a lot of people will be fascinated to know how you mimic the tone of voice of your footballer, your athlete, your soap star. Presumably you get, is it a talent for mimicry, or is it, because obviously each of these books reads very differently. What's that skill? Can you define it?
Well, I think probably, not mimicry, but I think probably you do, it helps if you have a bit of an ear. You obviously can't write down a Scottish accent, let's say, for the sake of argument. But what you can do is listen to the way people speak, inflections they have. Everybody uses certain words when they speak. So, bad example, but let's say somebody says wicked all the time. You can just throw in a few wickeds,
yeah,
and it'll sound like that person. But also, because you've recorded the conversations, when you hear them back, by the time you've spoken to somebody for 40 hours in a fairly concentrated way, you can get, they're sort of on your shoulder. And when you're typing, you're thinking, she wouldn't say that.
You said that you get close to the people that you write for. You become part of the family. You become something like a therapist occasionally. You live in their houses sometimes. What happens when that relationship finishes? Do perhaps both of you feel a little bereft at the end of this?
Well, I always,
what is very close
I always
relationship?
Do. Yeah. I always do feel rather bereft. And to begin with, when I sort of began doing it, I did stay friends with the people that I worked with. But then I do remember saying to somebody, oh, we must keep in touch, do keep in touch. And she said to me, I don't think we will keep in touch, but I will remember you fondly. And I thought she's quite right. I remember her fondly, and she remembers me fondly, and that's fine.
That was Fanny Blake, ghostwriter extraordinaire, telling us how to pretend to be someone else. We're asking, how do you write a biography? On today's Culture Show, up next, a political memoir with a big difference. As we've just heard, in crafting the biography of a public figure, a writer might need to spend countless hours with their subject. In addition to that, interviewing the relatives, friends, and going through loads of archival material is par for the course. But what if the subject is one of the world's most reclusive dictators, and pretty much all we know about them is through their country's elaborate propaganda machine? Well, British writer Michael Breen did just that when a decade ago he put pen to paper on one of the first biographies of North Korean ruler Kim Jong-il. Monocle Seoul correspondent Jason Struther sat down with the author for a chat about how to separate fact from fiction when he wrote about the so-called Dear Leader.
The late Kim Jong-il was rarely heard speaking publicly, neither abroad nor in North Korea. So for most of us, this caricature of Kim from the 2004 comedy Team America is all we got.
Hans Briggs! Oh no!
That same year, the writer Michael Breen did what some might consider an impossible task, published the biography, Kim Jong-il, North Korea's Dear Leader.
I'm so lonely, so lonely.
For three decades, Breen's been based here in South Korea and has traveled to the North seven times as a journalist. He never met Kim Jong-il, but came closer than most people ever did.
Yeah, the closest I got was I was in a small group that met his father. I did get a basket of fruit and flowers in the hotel room, which had a little card saying they were from him.
North Korea is somewhat famous for its opacity. How does one go about writing a biography about a reclusive dictator and one that, yeah, you've never had the chance to sit down and chat with face to face?
North Korea is a bit of an intelligence black hole, but you'd be surprised that there's a lot more, once you start looking at a specific subject, there's a lot more information out there than you might think. One of the front lines of intelligence on him was an Italian chef who was hired to teach his people how to cook pizza. There was a Japanese chef, similarly. In fact, the Japanese chef was the one to identify the current leader, Kim Jong-un, as the favored son. Then there are South Korean sources, there are defectors. I met one defector who'd been a fellow student, a friend of his at university.
How did you trust what they say about Kim Jong-il?
You need to have this sort of filter on to assess the value of what you're being told. Am I being told this because he thinks this is what I want to hear? Or am I being told this because is he exaggerating or is he minimizing? You know, so you try and cross-check things. And some things you just have to go with your gut instinct sometimes. This did occur to me at the time that the relative absence of information makes the job easier. You know, you need to use your imagination and powers of analysis a bit more, and you sort of go off on tangents a bit more, and you can come up with your own theories.
I think every writer wants to get good reviews of their books. Did you hear anything from North Korea about your Kim Jong-il biography? Did they say anything about it in their own media?
They wouldn't do that in their own media. I heard indirectly. Oh, and there was one go-between, a consultant who deals with them, advised me not to go. He said, this is not appreciated, because it was about the leader. But I think the royal family is a bit taboo. I'm sure I could go now, nobody would care. Frankly, it's a bit old. They're not going to put me in the gulag or anything like that.
Now that more than a decade has passed since you published a Kim Jong-il biography, do you wish you would have done anything differently?
The publisher was worried that he would die. So I was kind of hurried along, which I regret. And so it was a bit superficial. It was intended for an audience of people who didn't know about him. It wasn't a contribution to the North Korea watching community. Here's some insights into Kim Jong-il. It was basically what everybody who knew about him knew anyway. So I kind of regret having agreed to do it so quickly, and I regret having agreed to limit the audience in that way. I'd have liked to have gone more into depth and found something more deeper, which I still think is there. We don't know the story of Kim Jong-il yet. The other thing a big struggle I had was, while I don't think he was an evil man, I couldn't really find any redeeming qualities. I found that I didn't like him, and that made the writing extremely difficult.
Breen is now working on a biography of the late Reverend Moon Sun Myung, founder of the Unification Church, better known as the Moonies, hopefully a more likable character, well, at least compared to Kim Jong-il. For Monocle and Soul, I'm Jason Strother.
Thanks, Jason. And Mike Breen's book, Kim Jong-il, North Korea's Dear Leader, is published by John Wiley & Sons. Okay, how do you write a biography? Next, we're going to investigate the business side and sales potential of biographies. They do well in the book charts, what with famous name brand recognition and a semi-guaranteed audience. Kathy Rensenbrick is the books editor at the Bookseller magazine, and these are her pearls of wisdom.
Last year, celebrity autobiography didn't perform as well as it has done in the past. So I think that will lead to an industry rethink on how that works. And what people seem to feel now is, and this probably does sound a bit obvious, but it hasn't always been recognised, that it doesn't matter how great the celebrity is, the book itself also has to be good. That seems to be the view, that if the contents of the book aren't good, it doesn't matter how interested people are in the celebrity, the sales won't come through. Well, it's a very interesting genre because there's so much variation in it. Because obviously at the one end
you've got Wellington and Julius Caesar, and the other end you've got Kevin Peterson.
That's right, and you've got potentially sort of ghost-written, very picture-heavy autobiographies written by somebody who's only 21.
How we love
but
them.
But has won a competition or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
which I'm not being snooty about, because I think it's, you know, anything that makes people buy books is a good thing. And then, of course, there's a whole range of literary memoir. It becomes an art form in certain circumstances, tales of people's lives. There's so much going on in it, and lots of people will enjoy one section but not a different bit. So it's definitely something, probably as well, it's actually the same as fiction in that it doesn't surprise us that people who like thrillers might not like literary novels.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's an interesting genre as well on the bestseller lists, because as we say, encompasses such different personalities. I suppose the easy sell is that you will know this person from either a gardening show on the TV, and now here is their explosive biography, autobiography, or they are a great, you know, military leader, or a great prime minister, or a great sports star. And so I suppose there is the, what in advertising terms you'd call like brand awareness of these people. I suppose that helps them. But it's interesting you say that if the interior is fairly sparse.
if it's a desert,
then it doesn't fly.
Yes, it's what there is to say. So, for example, a biography that has done really well recently was Alex Ferguson of Manchester United. Mm. Because, again, that's viewed to be a very good book. He has lots of interesting things to say. There were secrets were revealed in it. And then it's quite interesting because Hodder are doing another book this year, which is a business book. So it's Alex Ferguson on leadership. And it'd be really interesting to see how that works, because for that to really work commercially, that probably has to appeal to people who are wanting to read that from a business point of view. So it's whether or not they will. I think they will, because I think I can think of lots of men I know that would quite like to be tucking into that book on Christmas afternoon. Of course, the autumn market, a lot of it is gift buying.
So the autumn market is leading right up to Christmas,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing. So let's take this as an example. Alex Ferguson, you know, one of the most famous and successful football managers of all time, talking about business. That, I mean, they're sort of maybe easily transferable skills, but presumably also you've got two big pillars of the book business. Business books, which we laugh at some of the naff titles and a terrible artwork on the covers of them, but presumably they sell in big, pretty big numbers, and then sports books and biography. You've got kind of you've got a triple threat.
Yes, that's exactly it. And then the big question with the Alex Ferguson book is, would somebody, say you've got some, I don't know, banker type or whatever, that might buy a book on leadership, but they're, say, a Spurs fan or a Chelsea fan, will they then want to buy the Alex Ferguson book on leadership? So there's all these interesting things to think about.
Let's talk about your own book, Cathy, which is sort of on that theme, which is a very honest portrayal of your own, you and your family life. You know, we can go into the reasons for writing that, but while we're on the subject of biography, does it help? Is it a cathartic experience? Did you find it a cathartic experience to do that? And can you wear a sort of personal and a professional hat at the same time? Whilst not while talking to me about it, but while doing your job and having written an autobiography.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Mm. And I do, what I genuinely do as I'm walking around now that, you know, my book will be published in July, I honestly tend not to think about it very much when I'm going about my other jobs. And I think that's quite a sane way to do it. Because and I have a rule with myself, I don't ever mention it unless someone mentions it first. So if I'm in some sort of work setting and somebody said, as they are doing, which is very nice, you know, I really loved your book, then I'm very happy to talk about it. But I don't ever raise it as a subject, because I think that would be, I don't know, unprofessional, or then it would make me feel odd. But people are being really kind about it, and that's nice. It does feel strange, but actually I do think probably one of the reasons why I wanted to write it, which did feel like a compulsion, it wasn't a sort of a strategy, it felt like a compulsion that I had to write it. And I think one of those things was that I wanted to feel somehow sort of more authentic as a person. So whilst I didn't in any way think any of this through, the fact that now lots of people, basically including all the people who employ me and give me money, have now read it and think it's really good.
Yeah.
So I now feel like I'm being open about everything.
And do you feel that, I mean, when you walk into a bookshop, do you think, oh, you know, knowing the interiors of your favourite bookshops, knowing the architecture of saleability, as it were, do you kind of, I mean, now you've got good notices for your own book. And that's a great feeling, presumably on its own. But do you kind of have a sort of, well, it could go there. I'd like to see it on this shelf. I'd like to see it on this table in this place. I mean, these are all sort of private thoughts made public. But I mean, there's...
Yeah, so obviously...
I wonder if you can sort of swap between the personal and the professional.
Yeah, I mean, I have a professional awareness of what happens in the build-up to book coming out. So I know that the markers and promotions that people look for. But interestingly, I think, what I actually try to do is ignore all of that and kind of forget that I know about that, because I've got a very good agent and I've got a very good editor and a very good publisher, and I actually want to leave all of that to them. And I would advise any author to do that, because I think what I find really fascinating is that it would be so easy to kind of almost forget about the huge achievement of writing the book and having it published and finding fellow travellers, you know, finding an agent and editor who believe in it, all of which really is that's sort of the point. And then if people read it and like it, that will be amazing. But it would be very easy to forget about that achievement and instead become completely obsessed about whether or not this good thing happens or that thing comes through. And I do think that's something, it's very interesting becoming an author, having observed them for years. And I'm kind of almost surprised that authors aren't crazier than they are, because it does, the whole process is designed to really, I mean, it really does help you discover the ego you didn't quite know you had.
Well, that's all good news, I think. I think our listeners will be pleased and be relieved to know that. And before we go, let's go back to the general theme of biography. What are a couple of titles, what are a couple of maybe expected, maybe unexpected titles that sort of lead the way for you, that you think anyone that is writing a biography about anyone from a drummer to a war hero should read before they pen to paper?
That's a good question. So again, in terms of, as we've just been talking about my book, some of the, there are grief memoirs that are amazing. So When Did You Last See Your Father by Blake Morrison, and Joan Didion's The Year of Magical Thinking. I think those are both excellent work of sort of literary memoir that would be well worth anybody reading. I like a lot of literary biography. So there's a book called The Mitford Girls, which is about those six sisters. And that's a really good look at how you balance and juggle all of that material.
That was books editor at The Bookseller, Kathy Rensenbrick. And her memoir, The Last Act of Love, is out in July and it's going to be published by Picador. When it comes to copyright and intellectual property, biographies aren't always the most straightforward stories to be told, and this couldn't be more true in the case of Brazil. Debates over what is and isn't allowed to be put in a biography in Latin America's largest nation has been a hot-button issue in recent years. It's led to some lawsuits, which has even led to a banning of some biographies in Brazil. So renowned Brazilian film and television actor Paulo Betti decided to poke fun at the controversial issue in his latest one-man show, aptly titled Authorised Biography. In this 90-minute play, Betty gives the audience a view into chapters of his own life with his own authorization, of course. Monocle's Rio de Janeiro correspondent Sheena Rossiter went to the theatrical production and spoke with Paulo Betti about what he thinks about the Brazil biography debate.
An audience files into a cozy yet sold-out theatre in Rio de Janeiro city centre.
O Centro Cultural dos Correios apresenta Autobiografia Autorizada.
With his best radio voice, Paulo Betti not so coyly introduces himself as the sole actor in his play, Biografia Autorizada, authorized biography in English.
Boa noite e bom espetáculo.
Minha mãe teve 15 filhos. Eu fui o 15º.
Barefoot and dressed in a white linen shirt and white linen pants, 62-year-old Paulo Betti boldly steps on stage, looking similar to a worker from one of Sao Paulo's many coffee plantations from times gone by. He starts to tell his story as the youngest of 15 children raised in rural Sao Paulo.
Aquele que anuncia mais filhos.
This theatrical piece has been a lifetime in the making. Paulo Betti has spent years writing about his humble upbringing, raised by an Italian immigrant family in the cultural melting pot that is Brazil. But instead of putting his story in a book, like most people do, the prolific actor opted to present it as a play, where he personally authorizes all its contents, and which is known to slightly change each time he's on stage. But despite personally presenting his own story, he doesn't disagree if authors write biographies without full permission over the artist's image, hence the sarcastic title of his play.
Obviously, the title is a bit of a joke because of the recent discussions that have been happening as of late over prohibiting biographies. There have been people trying to ban it. I am in favor of having biographies free to be released.
When With not much more than a simple set that resembles a basic farmhouse, prop clothing drying on clotheslines and all, and with a few projected pictures, Paulo exposes snippets of his life, many of which cause the audience to roar with laughter. He admits that this isn't a tell-all biography.
There were some things, jokes, that I didn't put in the piece that I was going to put in. There were details that were a little bit spicy to put in the biography. If I put them in, I would have been naked at the end. My daughter told me, "Don't do this, please, Dad." But then, after a long time of writing, I said that I have to be naked at the end to hold everyone's attention. But in the end, I didn't do this. Thank God.
Graças a Deus, ainda bem.
Alguma ereção, é. Olha, você me desculpe, não é nada pessoal.
Naked or not, everyone here seems to be laughing with Paulo, not at him. For many audience members here, Paulo Becci's biography is one shared by many other Brazilians too.
É uma peça interessante porque ela fala sobre...
Economist Osmio Boviero tells me that she finds the one-man show interesting, as it tells not just Paulo Becci's story, but the story of Brazil, with tales of immigration and social mobility, which are filled with cultural references. But these very Brazilian cultural references also cross over to a younger generation, as Mariana Bevar tells me how cultural references ring true to her.
It can bring me some memories, even if I wasn't born in the same period. Actually, I'm Italian, and I think there is many immigration things that are related to his story. Things that he said, some phrases, some came to me as my dad, that's also Italian, said to me.
A sound of applause bounces off the neatly sound-engineered theater walls. This authorized biography was clearly well-received, showing that biographies, authorized or not, serve as more than just entertainment for an audience, but rather also as a cultural reference for people's lives, a sign that the Brazilian debate over biographies will likely remain on the table for a while yet. For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Wow. So, how do you write a biography? You pick a famous or a notorious person, you focus on the juicy bits and make sure they're legal, you give it a good title and you try to keep yourself out of the picture as much as possible. How do you write a biography? With kid gloves at the keyboard, but still with broad brushstrokes too. Most importantly, get it right and try and get it in the papers too. Journalists love writers that do their job for them, don't you know? You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was the complete and unexpurgated Holly Fisher, The Life Story. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I have been Robert Bound. Thank you very much for tuning in.